When we left off last in the book of, when we were last together in Genesis, we read about how God did a great work in the life of, actually in the family of Jacob. He did a marvelous work of restoration, reunion, reconciliation. You remember how it all went? Joseph, at the age of 17, was sold by his brothers to Egypt into slavery. Joseph's father, Jacob, was told that Joseph had died. He'd been killed by a wild beast. So for the next 22 years, Jacob thought his son was dead. For the next 22 years, Joseph's brothers thought they had been rid of Joseph. They've gotten rid of him. But for the next 22 years, God was with Joseph, had raised him up in the land of Egypt so that he was second in command of the whole world, basically, prepared the whole world for a famine, stored up food, and now the famine is struck, and by God's providential design, the brothers, as we read last week, stand before Joseph, and there's reunion. And Joseph really gives his brothers a test, a strong test, before there's this reconciliation. But there is. There's a great restoration and reconciliation. Very emotional. In verse 14 of Genesis 45, as we read last week, it says, "Then he, Joseph, fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him." So Joseph and the brothers have been reunited. It's very emotional. The reunion continues tonight as we pick up the story. The restoration in the family continues. And tonight, we're going to see how God brings Joseph's entire family from Canaan into the land of Egypt. So let's read on now that the reunion between Joseph and his brothers is complete. Joseph has made himself known. Now let's read the story beginning in verse 16. "Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, 'Joseph's brothers have come.' So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Say to your brothers, do this. Load your animals and depart. Go to the land of Canaan. Bring your father and your households and come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you will eat the fat of the land. Now you are commanded, do this. Take carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives. Bring your father and come. And do not be concerned about your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours.' Then the sons of Israel did so. And Joseph gave them carts according to the command of Pharaoh, and he gave them provisions for the journey." So Pharaoh takes this report very positively. The arrival of Joseph's brethren is taken very positively. And in fact, Pharaoh extends an invitation to Joseph to invite his entire family to come back to the land. He wants to house the whole family. Now that says a lot about Pharaoh's appreciation for Joseph. It says a lot about Pharaoh's love for Joseph, fondness of Joseph. "Bring your whole family to the land." And by the way, as you're going to find out, there's 70 people in this family. Now, I'm all for having family come to visit. I love to have family members come and visit and stay at my house. It's a good time to catch up, but there's a price to pay with that. There's responsibility, right? Especially if there's friction between some of the family members, you know, and you have to worry about, is everybody eating? Is everybody happy? And so it's good. A week or two is great, and then it's time to go back home. Well, Pharaoh could have been very reluctant, but he's not. He loved Joseph, and because he loved Joseph, he loved all of Joseph's family, and he hadn't even met them yet. And he invites them to come back to the land. He's not reluctant at all. In fact, verse 16, it says, "Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, 'Joseph's brothers have come.' So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well." The Hebrew word there is, when they got the report that Joseph's brethren had gone by, Pharaoh viewed it as something very beautiful, precious. Hey, this is awesome. Joseph's family has arrived. That's wonderful. And Pharaoh then goes on, he's the guy in charge, to command the second in charge, Joseph, to go get his family and bring his family back. And look at the extravagant riches he's bestowing upon them. Say to your brothers in verse 17, do this, load your animals and depart, go to the land of Canaan. Bring your father and your households and come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt. You will eat the fat of the land. The best part is reserved for your family. Verse 19, you are commanded, do this. Take carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives. He's sending royal Egyptian wagons, carts, back with his brothers so that his father and little ones can come back in these royal carts. Then in verse 20, he says, do not be concerned about your goods. The best of all the land of Egypt is yours. Hey, don't worry about your furniture. Don't worry about bringing anything. The best of the land of Egypt is yours. Pharaoh loved Joseph. Pharaoh loved Joseph's family. You know, I think the family doesn't realize how blessed they were to have Joseph as a memory, as a member of that family. That family was so blessed because Joseph was a member of that family. And you know the old adage, it's not what you know, but who you know. Well, Joseph knew a lot, but he also knew Pharaoh. Pharaoh knew him well, loved him. And because of Joseph, Pharaoh's going to just pour out blessings upon the family. So, Joseph sends his brothers home, obeying the command of Pharaoh, verse 22. He gave to all of them, to each man, changes of garments. But to Benjamin, he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. That's interesting. Joseph gets them all redressed before their journey back, all of his brothers, but he gives Benjamin 5 garments while all the other brothers got 1, and he gives Benjamin 300 pieces of silver. Maybe a little bit of favoritism again, maybe another little test, probably. Verse 23, and he sent to his father these things, 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and food for his father, for the journey. So they're being sent off with lots of supplies for the journey back. Verse 24. So he sent his brothers away, and they departed. And he said to them, see that you do not become troubled along the way. I like that. That's like a protective father. Remember, these guys, these brothers are prone to getting lots of trouble, right? They've been in trouble before. And he's just very careful. You're going to go back. You've got all these riches. You got the carts. You got all these supplies. Don't get in any trouble on the way home, guys. Just come back. And the Hebrew word for trouble there, I believe it means fall out. Don't have a falling out on the way back. Don't sell Benjamin into slavery now. Don't, you know, come up with recriminations and any other false accusations. Remember, Joseph said, I've forgiven you. It's all forgiven. God was why I'm here in Egypt, not your sin of selling me into slavery. Just don't get in any trouble along the way. So they don't. Verse 25. Then they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still, because he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Then Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. It's not hard to understand why Jacob was so shocked at this news, right? I mean, in Jacob's mind, Joseph has been dead for 22 years. That's a long time to think your son, your most favorite son, is dead. The brothers come back and they say, Joseph is alive. He's governor of the land. And you can imagine his shock. Unbelievable. His heart stands still. What? Joseph's alive. And he doesn't believe it at all at first. But then they keep telling him all the words that Joseph shared with him. And notice, it says he looked around in verse 27, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. So seeing those Egyptian carts was the clincher. Those carts would have stood out like a sore thumb in that land. In the land of Canaan, there were no carts. There were no wagons like that. They weren't found in history at that time. Egypt was the one with these carts. Here comes this entourage of carts throughout the land. This entourage of royal Egyptian wagons pulls up into their front driveway. Imagine what the neighbors thought. This would be like the equivalent of a Boeing 747 landing in a tribal area somewhere. And so Jacob looks at these carts and thinks, wow, maybe what they're saying is true. And it is. Joseph is alive. The carts are the clincher. And notice the immediate transformation that takes place in Jacob. The end of verse 27. The spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. And Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. His spirit revived. This is a transformation in Jacob's life. This is the same guy we read about in Genesis chapter 42, who seemed to be at that point a bitter, older man. He was a guy who said, he had the attitude like this. All these things are against me. Bummer, 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 bummer. Life is just against me. All these things are against me. Joseph is no more. Simeon's no more. And pretty soon you're going to take Benjamin from me too. Bummer, bummer, bummer. All these things are against me. But now he finds out that all those things were not against him. They were for him. Joseph is alive. And the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. Now, let me ask you a question here, as this would apply to our Christian life. I think this is a neat picture. Think very carefully. What is it? What was the source of Jacob's revival? Why was his spirit revived? What caused it? Hearing the news that his beloved son had, in a sense, risen from the dead. Hearing that his beloved son had been raised to life. In Jacob's mind, Joseph had been dead for 22 years. Now he hears that he's alive. Doesn't that sound a lot like Christianity? I think it does. When we become Christians, one of the first things we hear the news about the beloved son who died and who is now risen again and brings revival to people's hearts. I think it's a great picture here. I think before we became Christians, many of us were like Jacob, kind of bummed out at life. Maybe there were some good times, but we didn't have all the answers to all the questions. Maybe we had the attitude, all these things are against me. And then somebody told us about God's beloved son who died on a cross and who rose again. And when we heard the news of that, it changed us. It revived us in our heart. It transformed us. We got answers to life. Answers to the questions. Our spirits became revived. We, in fact, became born again. That's a neat picture of what happened to us when we become Christians. And as I've been telling you throughout the study of the life of Joseph, Joseph is a very good picture of Jesus Christ, isn't he? He's a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. Things about his life foreshadow what Jesus would do later. This is one. As Joseph apparently was raised to new life figuratively, Jacob was revived. When Jesus was raised to new life, he gives us an opportunity to be revived. There's another way that we see that here before we leave, chapter 45. Notice also that, and we touched on this a little bit, Joseph's brothers were blessed for one reason. What was that reason? Joseph was in the family. Pharaoh poured out all this extravagant riches upon the brothers for Joseph's sake. You and I, as Christians, are like Joseph's brothers. Joseph is like the Lord Jesus Christ. Pharaoh is like God the Father. As Pharaoh poured out the riches upon Joseph's brother for the sake of Joseph, so God the Father has decided to pour out riches on us for Jesus' sake, because of Jesus. That's a good picture. It's a neat thing to see. That's a neat thing to understand, that Because of Jesus, you're rich. Because of what Jesus did, we're rich. I often think of what Paul the Apostle wrote in Ephesians chapter 1, written to every Christian, including every one of us in this room. We have been blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenlies in Jesus Christ. You, right now, are rich. Not because of who you are. I'm not rich because of who I am, but because of Jesus. In Christ, we're rich. And Joseph is a remarkable picture of that. And so in this pilgrimage, in this journey that we call life, consider a couple things. You're rich because of Jesus. And I would say to you, as Joseph said to his brothers, see to it that you stay out of trouble along the way. You're rich. God has blessed you. Don't have a falling out along the way in life. Stay reunited with people. Secondly, what I would say in this life, in this journey, in this pilgrimage, is let the news of the risen Savior keep your heart revived, always. Try not to oscillate like we see Jacob doing. You know, in Genesis chapter 42, all these things are against me. Genesis 45, his heart revives. You and I can always stay in a condition where our heart is revived, our life is revived, if we keep our eye on the sun, the risen sun. There may be times in life where we think that all things are against us, right? But if we can just remind ourselves, wait a minute, Jesus is alive. That's okay. He's defeated death. It keeps our perspective right. And also from a practical standpoint, I'd like to challenge everyone in this room. Make it your ambition. Make it your goal. Make it your constant prayer before the Lord that God would make you the Joseph in your family. You be the Joseph in your family. Have your family would just be absolutely blessed with great abundance because God had you be a member of it. Because that's what we see happening in Joseph's family. Because of Joseph, it's just blessing upon blessing upon blessing. And I challenge you, be the Joseph in your family. Remember, it's not what you know either, but who you know. You know Jesus. You know Him. And because of that, you're rich. And just let that blessing affect your family. I challenge you to do that. I think God will do great things. And I think He'll honor that and He'll answer that prayer for us. So, beautiful pictures of who Joseph is. Well, Israel decides, Jacob, they're excited, so they're going to go to the land. They're going to go to Egypt. Verse 1 of chapter 46. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. I think it's apparent here that Jacob got cold feet very shortly after this journey to Egypt began. And you know what? I give him credit for getting cold feet. I give him credit for it. Let me explain why. They're living in Hebron when he gets the news of Joseph. And so they begin traveling south. And a very important detail is that they go to Beersheba. They came to Beersheba. Beersheba was the southernmost part of the promised land. It's the southernmost part on the southern pinnacle.
It was like once you left Beersheba, it was like you were past the point of no return. You had nothing but wilderness all the way down to Egypt. So they make it to Beersheba, and it's here that Jacob begins to wonder, are they doing the right things? Beersheba was also an important place in their family. Abraham lived in Beersheba. Abraham planted a tree in Beersheba and constructed an altar there and gave offerings to the Lord there. Isaac had lived in Beersheba. Jacob and Esau had lived in Beersheba. Isaac also had constructed altars where they sacrificed to the Lord. So this is an important place, and Jacob is there in Beersheba sacrificing to the Lord. Now, here's what I think. I think he got to thinking. They're about ready to go beyond the point of no return. And he's in this sort of key place in his family history. And he got to thinking, you know, there was a famine once in the days of my grandfather, Abraham. There was a famine. And remember, Abraham went down into the land of Egypt. What happened to him? He got in a lot of trouble. He wasn't supposed to go down to Egypt. And then he got to thinking some more, you know, Isaac. There was a famine in Isaac's life as well, and he was going to go down to Egypt. But God came to him in a vision and specifically said, don't you dare go down to Egypt. Go to Gerar, another place, but don't go to Egypt. Maybe Jacob was thinking here, you know, wait, I better rethink this. Maybe I shouldn't go to Egypt. I mean, I want to see Joseph. I'm really looking forward to seeing him. But maybe I don't know for sure if I should go to Egypt. I think he's getting cold feet. And I think he's also remembering the promises. You're going to have a great family, a great nation, and where's it going to live? In the land of Canaan, in the land of promise. And he's thinking, I'm going down to Egypt. Perhaps he was even a little bit concerned for his own life. Maybe this isn't such a good deal. Maybe they'll kill me in Egypt. Well, it would appear that in this vision, God answered all those concerns. Look at verse 3. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. It was wrong for his grandfather to go, Abraham. It was wrong if Isaac would have gone to Egypt, but now it's right, and God is cluing him in. Jacob, it's okay. You can go to Egypt. You're going to become that great nation there. Your nation's going to come back. Don't worry. So he's answering all these fears. And as far as maybe possibly wondering whether or not he'd be killed or murdered in the land of Egypt, look at the end of verse 4. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. What does that mean? It's a Hebrew idiom. It literally means that your son Joseph, Jacob, will close the eyelids over your eyes on the day you die. So you're not going to be killed. You're not going to be murdered. You're going to die a peaceful death. And in fact, your most favorite son will be the one to put the eyelids back over the eyes. So he answers all those concerns, all those fears. And I think this meant a lot to Jacob. And I give Jacob tremendous credit here for getting cold feet. It could have been very easy. Joseph, yeah, pack him up, let's go. But I think it's important that he stepped back and thought, wait a minute. Maybe I should consult my Heavenly Father on this. How many of you do that? There's been times in my life where I think a door just busts wide open. Woohoo, here we go. And it leads to this big mess, and I say, Lord, what happened? And he said, well, you never asked me about it. You never consulted me. I think it's important to consult the Lord. Have him be a part of every decision you make, no matter how bright it might look. I mean, it was God's will for him to go to Egypt, right? It was. But it was a good thing that Jacob at least took some time. You know, when we do that, folks, when we do that, when we include the Lord in our decision making, and when we spend time in prayer, you know what that's telling the Lord? It's telling the Lord that we are voluntarily willing to depend on Him. It's telling the Lord that we need His wisdom. You know, we may be able to write everything down and see a path and, you know, advantages, pros, cons, and we make an educated decision. And then we just go forward with our decision. But that kind of says, you know, I've got this one, God. I'm okay with this. I can handle it. If we just simply be sure to include God in everything. It's acknowledging to the Lord that, yes, we need your help. And I think God honors that. And this was his will all along, but I give Jacob lots of credit here. So he's got the go ahead. Time to go. Verse 5. Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones and their wives in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. It's a good thing they sent those carts, bringing the kids. And also remember, Jacob has a permanent limp in his hip. It's good that he needed that. He needed that. Verse 6, so they took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. And now we're going to see a listing of all these people that went to Egypt in Jacob's family. Look at it very quickly. These were the names of the children of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi, you recognize all those names? These will be the tribes of Israel. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judah were Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. Remember the story of Tamar? The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Issachar were Tola, Puva, Job, and Shimron. The sons of Zebulun were Sered, Elon, and Jahaliel. These were the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padan Aram with his daughter Dinah. All the persons, his sons and his daughter, were 33. 33 sons from Leah's side. Verse 16, the sons of Gad were Ziphion, Haggai, Shinai, Esbern, Eri, Arodi, and I know I'm just butchering these names, but the sons of Asher were Jimnah, a few other. Verse 18, these were the sons of Zilpah, the concubine, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, 16 persons. Moving on now to Rachel, the sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, were Joseph and Benjamin. And to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Benjamin had some sons in verse 29. They were Bela, Becher, and a few others. Verse 22, these were the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. Sons of Dan, the sons of Naphtali in verse 24. Those were the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, 7 persons in all. So for 22 years, we kind of follow the story of what was happening to Joseph in Egypt. Well, in those same 22 years, a lot's happening back in the land of promise, back in the land of Canaan. The family's prospering. The family's multiplying. They're marrying. They're having children. And the total sum, the sum up list of the extent of the family that comes from the promised land to Egypt is in verse 26. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph, who were born to him in Egypt, were 2 persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. Important number. The family is 70 strong, at least 70 sons, 70 males. This is the family that makes their way into Egypt, 70 people. This number is going to swell. It's going to multiply
like you cannot believe in the next 430 years, right in that time frame.
When Moses leads the people of Israel out of Egypt, it is said that there will be about 600,000 able-bodied men. 600,000 able-bodied men. So that's not including women and children. It's estimated that they will swell to a nation the size of a little over 2 million people. So now, 70 people, 430 years later, 2 million. That is attacked by a lot of critics.
How in the world could that happen? How in 400 years could 70 people turn into a nation of 2 million?
Well, there were some guys that did some statistics, and I love it. I love that they can be proved wrong. They just looked at all these 70 people, and they included all the wives and other people that became a part of the family, starting way back with Abraham when he had Isaac. Starting right then, they figured the age, the time period, to this time period. And from that information, they figured out that on average, they were experiencing a 5 to 6% growth rate every year. On average. Okay. If you continue in a 5 to 6% per year growth rate in a family for 400 to 430 years, beginning with 70 folks, the answer is several million. So it could have very easily taken place. And besides, God was with them. God had just told Jacob, you can go down to Egypt. I'm going to make a great nation of you there. And so he was going to do it. Bringing them to Egypt was a big reason why he could allow such a multiplication. As we find out when we read on, because the conditions are just ripe for them to multiply. So 70 folks are going home, or not home, they're going to Egypt. And as they draw near to Egypt, we read in verse 28, then he, Jacob, sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you are still alive. Another beautiful, highly emotionally charged reunion. Father and son, they haven't seen each other for 22 years. First time in 22 years. They embrace, they hug, they weep. There's a lot of that going on in this story when Joseph sees his brothers. They weep, they hug, they embrace. You know, it's so beautiful how God is putting this family back together. It's so beautiful. When you see a family be restored, there should be weeping. There should be kisses and embraces and I don't know if any of you have ever had the pleasure of watching God put a family back together. Maybe you've been a part of a family that God put back together, or you've seen it. But there's nothing like it. God can do it. I just know He can do it. Even like in marriages that have been dead, say, for 22 years, He can breathe life right back into them. It can be done, and it should be highly emotional. It is here. Verse 31. And Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they have brought their flocks, their herds, and all that they have. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation, that you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth, even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, I think this is well thought out. I think Joseph has been making plans for the arrival of his family. They show up in Goshen. Joseph shows up. They have a reunion and he tells his brothers, bros, I'm going to go talk to Pharaoh. I'm going to tell him that you're here. I'm also going to tell Pharaoh what your occupation is. You're a shepherd. All right. But he's anticipating that Pharaoh will ask them themselves what their occupation is. Verse 33. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? Joseph is telling his brothers how to respond. You shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth, even till now, both we and also our fathers. Joseph is telling his brothers to use a little tact here. He's saying, make it very clear to the Pharaoh that you are shepherds,
but don't use that word. Don't use the word shepherd. Shepherd's a dirty word in Egypt. And it was. And so Joseph is trying to get his brothers, you know, use a little bit of tact when he asks you what your occupation is. Don't call yourself shepherd. Answer like this. Say, our occupation has been with livestock. A livestock engineer. I don't know, something like that. A different word, but not a shepherd. Don't use a shepherd. The Egyptians despised shepherds. Very clear in history. Murals have been found. Paintings have been found that, you know, the Egyptians had done, and they show these pictures of shepherds, and all of them are always crippled and very dirty. They just didn't like, they detested shepherds. They were an agricultural nation, but it was mostly with farming crops. They didn't have a whole lot to do with livestock. If they did, meager servants would tend. They didn't care much for shepherds. So now think about this. The family of Joseph has two strikes against them from Egypt's perspective, right? Yet these two strikes against them turn out to be tremendous advantages and benefits to them and part of God's plan. Remember, the Egyptians despised foreigners. They wouldn't eat with foreigners. They wouldn't eat with a Hebrew. They didn't even eat with Joseph. They got that against them. Strike one. Strike two. They're all involved in an occupation despised by the Egyptians. They couldn't stand shepherds. You know what that's going to do? That's going to keep this small family of 70 in a safe little pocket, all by themselves in Egypt. And in fact, as you read, they're going to be in the land of Goshen. Another name for that city, Goshen, is Ramses. It's right at the delta of the Nile in Egypt. It was the most fertile spot in the land. It was the best pasture land. The family is going to go to the best pasture land on the planet at that time and have no disturbances from Egyptian because they were filthy, rotten, foreign shepherds. Folks, this is an absolute perfect incubator for multiplication of a nation. It's perfect. It's beautiful to see God's plan in doing this. There they are. They're going to be saved, and it's great stuff. So we really see God's hand in this. So there's the plan. Verse 1 of 47. Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen. And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Five of the brothers stand before Pharaoh, and it's interesting that they're not named. I've been very curious, wondering, I wonder which brothers stood before Pharaoh. You think Benjamin, probably. Judah, but, you know, it's all speculation. There's the question that Joseph had anticipated in verse 3. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? And they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. They used the dirty word. They didn't say we were a livestock engineer. We're shepherds. They forgot. Can you just see Joseph? No, I told you. Yeah, that's the difference between Joseph and his brothers. That's the difference between really somebody who's wise. You know, somebody who's wise has tact. Joseph understood the the language and the people and the culture and the backgrounds and from where they're coming from. And you just see this wellspring of wisdom in Joseph. His tactfulness and his ability to deal with people. And then with his brothers, it's like, we're shepherds. You know, they don't think about it. So there's no tact here, but, good for them. Pharaoh doesn't hold it against them. He loves Joseph and he's going to take care of him. Verse 4, the brothers continue and they said to Pharaoh, we have come to dwell in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks. For the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent man among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock. And Joseph,
isn't that great? So Pharaoh, they didn't use any tact, but he lets them go live in that best part, Goshen. And in fact, look, if your brothers, if there's anyone any good, I'll let them work with my servants and working with the royal cattle and livestock. So Pharaoh's been very good. Once again, because of who Joseph is.
Now it comes time for Joseph to introduce his father to Pharaoh. And his father to and Pharaoh to his father. Verse 7. Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. This is kind of an interesting encounter. Here you have the most important person, the most important ruler in the world, Pharaoh. And then you have this older gentleman, 137 years old. He's a patriarch, 130 years old. He's a patriarch. Maybe he's seen very insignificant. He's an aged man, and here they are standing before one another. The Pharaoh was very curious about his age. He looked old. So he asked him, how old are you? And Jacob tells him, I'm 130 years old. Egypt was known for respecting the older people in their land. You see that in their history. They respected old people. But what we do know also about Egypt is not many of the Egyptians lived to be a very old age. Most Egyptians never made it to the age of 90, so we were told. And there were information found, documents found that say that the Egyptians attached a special novelty to anyone who ever reached the age of 110. If someone in their culture lived to be 110, they were thought, wow, the God's hands really was upon that person. They were really elevated and really revered and looked up to, sort of knighted or whatever, as a saint or whatever. Well, Jacob's 130 years. And that must have really impressed Pharaoh. And, they respected the older people anyways, and especially because of the type of son that Jacob had had in Joseph. So there's respect there. And notice, it seems kind of backward, doesn't it? Verse 7, when they meet, at the end there it says, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Then in verse 10, so Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. Doesn't that seem odd? Why would this older aged patriarch who lived way out in the middle of nowhere bless the number one ruler in the world? And why would he accept it? What did the Pharaoh need? From our perspective, we would think the Pharaoh should bless Jacob, right?
But it's not so. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. There's a principle that I want you to see here. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 7. You don't need to turn there. It just says this. Without contradiction, the lesser is always blessed by the greater. The lesser is blessed by the greater. Who's being blessed here? Pharaoh. Who's the lesser? Pharaoh. Who's the greater? Jacob, this 130-year-old aged man. You see, in God's books, in God's perspective, his people are greater. No matter what position they might have in life. And listen, that's very backward for us to think about here in America. It is. Our goal here in America is to become the CEO, to become the person in charge. That way we can be blessed and bless others, you know, at our convenience. And you might have a job where, you know, you're working for somebody, you don't care for it that much, you get pushed down a little bit. Listen close. Jacob was greater than the number one ruler in the world in God's books. Jacob was the only one who could give true blessings because he belonged to God. I believe that every Christian is so important and so rich and so much greater than other people in the world, no matter what their occupation might be. And I want you to remember that. Because I remember getting beat up all the time in jobs that I had. Have to answer to some boss who, or somebody who just thinks they're better than you. Oh, you go, you little gopher boy. And there I'd go, run out and get the gopher. And you know, they make you feel bad. In this world, you can be made to feel bad if you're in a position of servanthood. How different Christianity is here. Jesus said the great. Right now in your life, doesn't matter if you're standing before the number one CEO in your company or in the land or whatever, you're important because you belong to God. And I think that's a real beautiful picture here. Jacob blesses Pharaoh and Pharaoh accepted it. Verse 11. So Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread, according to the number in their families. So that is the story of Joseph's family getting to Egypt. He gets them there. And they're in the best of the land, and they're in that pocket. They're in that safety. They're going to expand. They're going to multiply. Joseph also, we can't say enough about Joseph, but he acted very noble through this whole situation, didn't he? Again, he's very tactful, but again, he doesn't push his boundaries. You notice how he asks Pharaoh about everything first? He gets everything lined up with Pharaoh, doesn't he? Doesn't go beyond his boundaries. He doesn't step on anybody's shoes. It's, again, you can't say enough about his tactfulness and his wisdom and his concern for his family. So they're safely there. However, there is work to be done. Remember, there's a famine in the land. A dream that they had, God said that there would be 7 good years in all the land, and then there would be 7 bad years. Well, Joseph had stored up food for 7 years. The famine had begun, and they were probably only 2 or 3 years into the famine at this point when the brothers take up residence in Egypt. Well, Joseph is second in command. He's still got work to do. He's got to deal with the famine. And so we get an opportunity to see him go to work here. And again, you see his wisdom. Verse 13. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt, in the land of Canaan, for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. So this famine is incredibly severe. Nobody's got any grain anywhere. And you remember, Joseph had it set up so that all the grain was stored and people could come and purchase the grain with money. Well, what happens many times in catastrophes, you know, famines, the Great Depression, is the money fails, right? It's one of the first things that happen. And the money fails here. They don't have enough. They can't purchase the grain. That's a big problem. And they come up to Joseph and say, you know, give us bread. Why should we die in your presence? So Joseph has to think quick. Verse 16. Then Joseph said, give your livestock and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. Okay, you're out of money? Well, let's barter. Bring your livestock. Let's trade. You give me your livestock, I'll give you grain. So Joseph is building, he's accumulating a lot of wealth here, but he's also taking care of the people. Now, remember the Egyptians detested shepherds. But I'll bet it was kind of sweet for a shepherd now in Egyptians' household because all the livestock and cattle are going there. I'm sure Joseph's brothers were being taken care of. The next year, it continues. The famine continues. When that year had ended in verse 18, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. My Lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread. And we in our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their lands. So the money's gone. The livestock's gone. The famine's still going. They still need to eat. There's grain available. What do? They give themselves. They sell their land. They become servants to Pharaoh. And Joseph buys them. Joseph buys the land and gives it to Pharaoh. He's making Pharaoh a very wealthy man. But at the same time, he's helping the people and the people are willing to do this. This is an emergency, folks. So he's working at it from both angles. The only land he doesn't buy is the priests. Priests were in charge of the temple and the religious structures within Egypt. Their land wasn't tillable anyways. Nobody's going to break down a temple. So they didn't have the priests sell their land. All the people are moved into the cities where they can be managed better. Verse 23, then Joseph said to the people, indeed, I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your household, and as food for your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. So very wise thing. He purchases the land and then in a sense gives the land back. It still belongs to Egypt, but he gives them the seed and you go plow the land and you keep four-fifths of the produce of the land. This is obviously after the famine now is starting to go away. But give one-fifth of the land back to Pharaoh. So what quick dividers and mathematicians out there, what was the tax rate in Egypt? 20%. Now, I know a lot of people in this country that would be happy with 20%. You think of all the taxes that we pay. Income, sales, property, on and on and on and on. It's a 20% tax rate. And it all seems good. The people are, hey, you've saved our lives, Joseph. It all works. You know what's going on here, though, and this can be kind of dangerous, is, you know, a tragedy comes to a land, and what happens? The government has to react, right? And usually in tragedies, you kind of see it, a central government either emerges or becomes stronger. And we see that's what's happening with Pharaoh here. That whole central government's becoming stronger. Now, that's okay when someone good's in charge. Right? Joseph's around. He can be trusted. But in 400 years, there's going to be a new Pharaoh in town. And that same central government. And they're going to begin to treat the Hebrews very harshly. And at that point, God is going to go against Egypt. But at this point, everything's working out okay. Everything, you know, the Hebrews are being well taken care of. Joseph is taking care of business. Verse 27. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly. There they are, growing, multiplying. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you have said." Then he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed. Jacob lived to be 147 years. 130 years were spent in the Promised Land and in Haran. 17 years in Egypt in this place of Goshen. When it comes time for him to die, he calls Joseph to the bedside. And he has a request for Joseph. "Listen, don't bury me here when I die. Promise me that you'll take me to the land of our forefathers." Where was that? Well, back in the Promised Land, back in the land of Canaan. Probably the exact grave that and tomb site that Abraham had purchased. And the other people in the family, their bodies were laid there. And Jacob says, "Be sure to take me back there when I die." And he makes Joseph promise and swear. And remember, puts the hand under the thigh. That was a swearing by posterity. Okay? "Any descendants from me, Joseph, if you don't live up to this, can avenge you after my death. Can avenge me on you after my death." He didn't need to do that. Joseph's completely trustworthy. But he says, "Take my bones." Now, why would he do that? What's in Jacob's mind? Well, it's an eye to the future, isn't it? Jacob, or Israel, knows that God is still going to continue to do a work after his death. There's a promise. The people are going to go back to that land. He knows they're going to go back to that land. And he says, "You know what? Make sure my bones are buried there, because where your body was buried sort of identified you with your homeland." And so he's dying with an eye to the future. He's getting things ready. And he knows that God is going to continue with this purpose and this plan even beyond his life. Jacob had a full life. It says that he was laying with his head on his bed, or his staff there at the end of that chapter. Hebrews chapter 11 tells us that at this point in his life, what he would do is he would lean on his staff in his bed and he would worship the Lord there. It's that old man just hold himself up and worship the Lord. And look forward to what would happen with his descendants and everything that would take place after this. I think we need to take principles from his life and what we see him doing. Jacob realized that life goes on after death. And in fact, remember when he stood before Pharaoh and Pharaoh asked him, "How old are you?" How did he respond to that? Remember? Where was that? Look back at that again. Chapter 47, verse 7. It's curious the way Jacob responds to his life. Verse 9. Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Pilgrimage. How does he describe his life? It's a pilgrimage. It's just a journey. It's just a passing through. It's just a stranger. That's how he saw his life. There's something better. God has plans in the future. There's a place called heaven. In fact, that's in the key factor of anybody who's considered a man or woman of faith in the Bible. According to Hebrews chapter 11, speaking of the great saints, it says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they say such things, declare plainly, that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of the countries from which they had come out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." God's people look forward to heaven. We look forward to heaven. And I guess as we close the study tonight, I always try to like to bring, you know, kind of we have a hodgepodge of things that come up in every study, but let's conclude with this. Remember tonight again that your life is a journey. It's just a pilgrimage. It's a mist. The Bible clearly says that our citizenship is in heaven. Now hear that well. Your citizenship is in heaven. Not El Paso. Not the United States. It's in heaven. We are just passing through. And so as we pass through, let us hold on to the things of eternity very firmly, and let us hold on to things of the earth very lightly. And remember again some of the things that we learned in this pilgrimage, in this thing called life. Realize that because of Jesus Christ, you've been blessed. You have great riches. As you travel through this life, be constantly revived in knowing that Jesus Christ is alive. Remember the news, the beloved Son is risen. Keep that perspective fresh. Live your life desiring to be a Joseph in your family, at your workplace. And live your life longing for heaven. It's going to be wonderful. Heaven is going to be great. And live your life trying to be wise, asking for the wisdom of God, being tactful. Like a Joseph, being a fruitful Christian, making the most of this short-term time that in fact does have such an impact on what happens in the next life. Right now is the only time we'll ever get to really serve the Lord in this capacity. This is it. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that you have called us out of the darkness into your light. God, I thank you that we know that we're citizens of heaven. Lord, thank you for making it possible for us to go there. Father, I pray that we would make the most of this pilgrimage, of this journey. Father, make us wise like Joseph. Make us tactful. Give us great skill in dealing with people from all kinds of backgrounds. Lord, make us like Joseph in our families. May others be blessed because we're a member.
And because of who we know you. Lord, revive us constantly with the ever-conscious fact of the fact that your Son is alive and He's with us right now. He lives in our heart. May that revive us, no matter what situation in life we face. And then, Father, as we saw with Jacob, I pray, Lord, that we would always have an eye to the future, to the next life. For you have said that our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Praise you, Lord. These troubles are light. May we put them in perspective, in the perspective of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.